So I'm just going to ask your patience, because I'm speaking and I'm running these clips, and I'm not that great at multitasking, so it might be a little bit more halting than we like. Anyway, thank you very much, David. I'm here to speak on controversy in science. What's the poor journalist to do when scientists disagree? So we all know that controversy, science, and the media can be a volatile mix that causes and reflects a deep misunderstanding of the scientific process. So today I'd like to examine three areas of the controversies that NOVA has been involved in and explore the difficulties involved in handling them. The first is the mother of all controversies between science and the public, evolution. With a few exceptions, evolution is universally accepted among biologists. But in a 2012 Gallup poll, 46% agreed that God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years. The number 46% has remained essentially unchanged for the past 30 years, and throughout this time, NOVA has treated evolution like any other scientific fact. We believe that by acknowledging the controversy, we would legitimize it. In retrospect, perhaps this was wishful thinking, a yearning for simplicity represented by this view of evolution. So who are these 46% of Americans who don't accept evolution? Many of them march in the army of the culture wars, evangelical Protestants and biblical literalists. Many scientists deride these folks as religious nuts, Bible thumpers, and fanatics, and doubtless some of them are. But they've gotten a lot more sophisticated in the past several years, switching their tactic from creationism, the literal interpretation of Genesis, to something called intelligent design, or ID. ID purports to be a scientific theory based on the idea that some aspects of nature are simply too complex to have arisen by evolution, and therefore must be the product of an intelligent designer. A few years ago, Intelligent Design Adherents sponsored a feature documentary hosted by the actor and New York Times columnist Ben Stein, deriding the treatment of its point of view by the scientific community and linking evolution with the Holocaust and eugenics. And here's a clip from that movie.
Institution seized by First Army troops. Under the guise of an insane asylum, this has been the headquarters for the systematic murder.
So what is this place?
During the Second World War, 15,000 people were killed here.
Why were they killed?
They were killed because they were people with handicaps.
Why kill them? What's the point of killing them?
People who were not able to work, people who were not able to live by themselves, that they were useless eaters.
Useless eaters.
And life unworthy of living.
The
this idea grew up in the 20s. So long before National Socialism, biologists, anthropologists, they thought that maybe mankind could, or the government could interfere into the growth of the population.
I see.
And they had the utopia that they would have a society without illness and without handicap.
Alles Lebensschwache geht in der Natur unfehlbar zugrunde.
Wir Menschen haben gegen dieses Gesetz der natürlichen Auslese in den letzten Jahrzehnten furchtbar gesündigt. Wir haben unwertes Leben nicht nur erhalten, wir haben ihm auch Vermehrung gewährt. Die Nachkommen dieser Kranken sahen so aus. Die tiefer stehen als jedes Tier.
A Darwinian concept.
Yes.
And also a Malthusian concept, very much Malthusian.
Malthusian?
Thomas Malthus, who said that there was a shortage of resources, English philosopher, so there was a shortage.
Yes, but the Nazis, they relied on Darwin.
They relied on Darwin.
Yes, Darwin and German scientists.
Patients were led down this.
So, ever since the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925, memorialized in the movie Inherit the Wind, the courts have been the primary battleground in the war on evolution, through a series of challenges to the teaching of evolution in schools based on creationism. These have been consistently rejected as a violation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, the part of the First Amendment that says that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. But in 2005, in the small town of Dover, Pennsylvania, Intelligent Design got into the act, and so did Nova. Here's how we set the scene for a two-hour special called Judgment Day, Intelligent Design on Trial.
In 2004, a war broke out in the small town of Dover, Pennsylvania.
Today, the teachers in a rural Pennsylvania town became the first in the country required to tell students that evolution is not the only theory.
It started when the Dover Area School Board passed a policy requiring that its high school science classes include a controversial subject called intelligent design. Proponents of intelligent design claim that many features of living organisms are too complex to have evolved entirely through the natural process of evolution, as Charles Darwin proposed. Instead, they claim some aspects of those organisms must have been created, fully formed, by a so-called intelligent designer. And advocates contend intelligent design is a bold new scientific theory with the power to overthrow the theory of evolution.
It's scientists debating science based on the evidence, not based on any religious text or authority, and it's clearly properly the subject of a science class.
It's in fact opening the path of inquiry to new ways of thinking about things.
Evolution by natural selection is a scientific doctrine, then a critique of that. A doctrine is a legitimate part of science as well.
The Dover School Board demanded that science teachers read their students a one-minute statement claiming that gaps in the theory of evolution exist and putting forward intelligent design as an alternative. The statement also directed students to an intelligent design textbook called Of Pandas and People that would be made available. But many Dover residents and an overwhelming number of scientists throughout the country were outraged. They say intelligent design is nothing but religion in disguise, the latest front in the war on evolution.
The goal of intelligent design is to try to re-Christianize American society.
Intelligent design is not anywhere a scientific concept. It's not a field of science. It's not being actively researched by anyone.
It's a violation of everything we mean and everything we understand by science.
The stage was set for a battle that would pit friend against friend and neighbor against neighbor.
It was like we shot somebody's dog. I mean, there was a blow up like you couldn't believe.
It was like a civil war within the community, there's no question.
was over, this battle would land the school board in federal court. No cameras were allowed in the courtroom. So to bring this historic showdown between evolution and intelligent design to light, Nova has dramatized key scenes from court transcripts. It was a 6-week trial in which modern biology was Exhibit A. And hanging in the balance was not just the Dover biology curriculum. The future of science education in America, the separation of church and state, and the very nature of scientific inquiry were all on trial.
So what caused us from our normal way of handling the evolution controversy was the fact that this trial was really unique. More than a debate over legal issues, it turned out to be a primer on evolution with scientists as the main witnesses. But as you just heard, there were no cameras allowed in the courtroom, so we realized that we would have to dramatize sections of the trial. And this presented a problem, since not only is drama somewhat out of Nova's wheelhouse, it's extremely expensive. Luckily, we had a partner with the money and the experience, Vulcan Productions, owned by Paul Allen in Seattle. Richard Hutton was executive producer for Vulcan, and we worked together to make this Nova special. And Richard, who's here today, in the last row here, is now executive producer, executive director of the Carsey Wolf Center at UCSB. So having decided to dramatize the trial, we had to go through thousands of pages of testimony and condense long sections of questions and answers into watchable segments, all the while retaining the original meaning. Naturally, we had lawyers all over us, making sure everything we did was completely kosher. The star witness for the prosecution, the group of parents suing the school board, was Ken Miller, a biologist from Brown University, who started out by showing how modern science has proven the validity of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. And so let's see how he did it.
Darwin was convinced that species evolve over time through natural selection acting on inherited traits. But he had no idea how those traits arose or how they were passed from generation to generation. When 20th century scientists discovered the role DNA plays in heredity, they founded a new science called genetics that put Darwin's theory to the test. Virtually every cell in every living thing contains chromosomes, which are made of densely packed strands of DNA that function as a blueprint of the individual organism's characteristics. During reproduction, chromosomes from each parent replicate and shuffle their parts to produce new chromosomes. Then each parent passes chromosomes to offspring. But the process is imperfect. Along the way, DNA is subject to random mutations or mistakes, giving each offspring its own unique blueprint. Sometimes this produces characteristics in offspring that are benign. Other times it produces harmful characteristics, like a misshapen wing. But occasionally, the process gives rise to a beneficial trait. For example, a butterfly whose coloration mimics another species that tastes bad to birds. About 100 years after Darwin proposed that natural selection acts on new traits appearing in a population, genetics revealed the biological mechanism that gives rise to those traits in the first place.
And therefore, you could say that when modern genetics came into being, everything in Darwin's theory was at risk. Could have been overturned if it turned out that genetics contradicted the essential elements of evolutionary theory. But it didn't contradict them. It confirmed them in great detail.
And as Miller would testify, a genetics paper published less than a year before the trial had confirmed what has long been the most inflammatory part of Darwin's theory, the common ancestry of humans and apes. That paper explored a curious discrepancy in our chromosomes. The cells of all great apes, like chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, contain 24 pairs of chromosomes. If humans share a common ancestor with apes, you'd expect us to have the same number. But surprisingly, human cells contain only 23 pairs.
The question is, if evolution is right about this common ancestry idea, where'd the chromosome go? Well, evolution makes a testable prediction. And that is that somewhere in the human genome, we ought to be able to find a piece of scotch tape holding two chromosomes together so that our 24 pairs, two of them were pasted together to form just 23. And if we can't find that, then the hypothesis of common ancestry is wrong and evolution is mistaken. Next slide.
To solve this riddle for the court, now, Miller would show how scientists discovered traces of our evolutionary past buried in the very structure of a chromosome carried by all humans. Typically, on the ends of every chromosome, you should find special genetic markers, or sequences of DNA, called telomeres. And in their middles, you should find different genetic markers called centromeres. But if a mutation occurred in the past, causing two pairs of chromosomes to fuse, we should find evidence in those genetic markers. Telomeres not only at the ends of the new chromosome, but also at their middles, and not one, but two centromeres. Finding a structure like this in our chromosomes would explain why humans have one pair fewer than the great apes.
And if we don't find that, then evolution is in trouble. Next slide. Lo and behold, the answer is in chromosome number two. All of the marks of the fusion of those chromosomes predicted by common descent and evolution, all those marks are present on human chromosome number two. So the case is closed in a most beautiful way. And that is, the prediction of evolution of common ancestry is fulfilled by that lead pipe evidence that you see here, in terms of tying everything together. That our chromosome, formed by the fusion from our common ancestor, is chromosome number two. Evolution has made a testable prediction, and it has passed.
So modern genetics and molecular biology actually support evolutionary theory?
They support it in great detail. And the closer we can get to looking at the details of the human genome, the more powerful that evidence has become.
It's really a pretty piece of science, isn't it? Now, to make its case, the defense listed 8 expert witnesses, including 5 from the Discovery Institute, a Seattle organization that promotes intelligent design. But 5 of those witnesses never testified with no explanation, nor would they speak to us despite repeated requests. The main strategy of the defense was to show that intelligent design presented a credible scientific, not religious, alternative, thus escaping the burden of the Establishment Clause. To do this, the defense counted on its star witness, Michael Behe from Lehigh University, author of dozens of papers unrelated to intelligent design. Behe also refused to grant us an interview, though he did go on record in the trial. So let's see how that worked out.
Dr. Behe, what is your profession?
I am a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
And you're a biochemist?
And that's correct, yes.
How long have you taught at the college level?
And for 23 years.
Sir, what is intelligent design?
Intelligent design is a scientific theory that proposes that some aspects of life are best explained as the result of design, and that the strong appearance of design in life is real and not just apparent.
Is intelligent design based on any religious beliefs or convictions?
No, it isn't.
What is it based on?
It is based entirely on observable, empirical, physical evidence from nature, plus logical inferences.
Now, when you use the term design, what do you mean?
Well, I discuss this in my book, Darwin's Black Box, and a short description of design is shown in this quotation from chapter 9. Quote, "What is design? Design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. When we perceive that parts have been arranged to fulfill a purpose, that's when we infer design." End quote.
Part of the defense strategy would be to show the judge examples of biological systems they claimed were too complex to have evolved by natural selection, and therefore must have been the product of a designer.
Can you give us a biochemical example of design, Dr. Beege?
Yes, that's on the next slide. I think the best, well, the most visually striking example of design is something called the bacterial flagellum. Now, this is a figure of a bacterial flagellum taken from a textbook, which is widely used in colleges and universities around the country. The bacterial flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. And in order to accomplish that function, it has a number of parts which are ordered to that effect. Now, this part here, which is labeled filament, is actually the propeller of the bacterial flagellum. The motor is actually a rotary motor. And most people who see this and have the function explained to them quickly realize that these parts are ordered for a purpose and therefore bespeak design.
Under the microscope, bacteria powered by flagella seem almost acrobatic. They tumble, corkscrew, and pirouette, thanks to that whip-like filament. Driving this propeller is a tiny motor, part of a complex structure made of about 40 different kinds of proteins.
The bacterial flagellum looks like a sort of Jules Verne notion of what the future looks like. It has a strange sort of mechanical quality to it, these sort of cogs and waving tails and stuff.
And according to Beege, if any one of these parts is missing from the system, the motor can't function. Beege calls systems like this irreducibly complex, a term he coined. And he argues such systems could not have evolved naturally.
Have other scientists acknowledged these design features of the flagellum?
Yes, they have. If you could advance the next slide. In 1998, a man named David DeRosier wrote an article in the journal Cell, which is a very prestigious scientific journal, entitled "The Turn of the Screw, the Bacterial Flagellar Motor." Now, David DeRosier is a professor of biology at Brandeis University in Massachusetts and has worked on the bacterial flagellar motor for most of his career. Now, in that article, he makes a statement. Quote, "More so than other motors, the flagellum resembles a machine designed by a human," close quote. So David DeRosier also recognizes that the structure of the flagellum appears designed.
What I wrote was, this is a machine that looks like it was designed by a human, but that doesn't mean it was designed. It is the product of intelligent design. Indeed, this more has all the earmarks of something that arose by evolution. This is the drive shaft. This transmits this torque generated by the motor. That would then turn the propeller, which would push the bacterial cell through the fluid.
Michael Beege has argued that the flagellum could not have evolved, since its parts have no function for natural selection to act on until they are fully assembled. But evidence that refutes Beege's claim of irreducible complexity comes from a tiny syringe that injects poison, found in some of the nastiest of all bacteria.
This is a structure found, for example, in Yersinia pestis, the bacterium that causes the bubonic plague. And look at the similarities.
And it turns out the two structures look similar for a reason. The syringe on the right is made of a subset of the very same protein types found in the base of the flagellum on the left. Though the syringe is missing proteins found in the motor and therefore cannot produce rotary motion, it functions perfectly as an apparatus for transmitting disease.
So if we think about what it means to be irreducibly complex, the argument is that if you take away even one of these proteins, that the structure cannot function. And yet here is a structure that functions, that is missing several of the proteins, and yet here it is, a working viable organelle of the bacterium.
To emphasize Derosier's point, Miller arrived at court making an unusual fashion statement.
As an example of what irreducible complexity means, advocates of intelligent design like to point to a very common machine, the mousetrap. And the mousetrap is composed of five parts. It has a base plate, the catch, a spring, a little hammer that actually does the dirty work, and a bait holder. The mousetrap will not work if any one of these five parts are taken away. That's absolutely true. But remember the key notion of irreducible complexity, and that is that this whole machine is completely useless until all the parts are in place. Well, that turns out not to be true. And I'll give you an example. What I have right here is a mousetrap from which I've removed two of the five parts. I still have the base plate, the spring, and the hammer. Now, you can't catch any mice with this, so it's not a very good mousetrap. But it turns out that despite the missing parts, it makes a perfectly good, if somewhat inelegant, tie clip. And when we look at the favorite examples for irreducible complexity, and the bacterial flagellum is a perfect example, we find the molecular equivalent of my tie clip, which is we see parts of the machine missing 2, 3, 4, maybe even 20 parts, but still fulfilling a perfectly good purpose that could be favored by evolution. And that's why the irreducible complexity argument falls apart.
So to make a program about a controversy, when one side gives you full and enthusiastic access and the other side none at all, is difficult. No matter how legitimate your effort to give both sides a hearing, there's always the risk of appearing unfair. And in this case, that was compounded by the fact that the arguments the defense witnesses presented were just so weak. But the wild card in this case was always the judge. John Jones III, a Republican recommended by then Senator Rick Santorum and nominated by George Bush. Highly intelligent but untutored in science, Judge Jones decided for the prosecution and a landmark ruling that has yet to be challenged. Now, this program was very successful for NOVA with great viewership and lots of buzz, and teachers all over the country use it along with the educational materials that we developed. Here's my favorite letter from a student at Ohio State whose professor showed the program in class. It's a quote, "I'm a 30-year-old active duty Marine. I was raised in a really firm Christian home where evolution was not even considered an option or possibility. Your film made me realize how ignorant people really are with regard to science, including myself. Evolution and religion can both exist together. I never would have believed I could come around to this way of thinking. I feel as though a light went on and everything you've been talking about fell into place." Yet the controversy continues, bitter as ever. And there's a lesson in this for the scientific community. This case, we never had made it to court were it not for the willingness of a small number of scientists to take the stand against evolution. No matter that it was such a tiny number when compared to the vast majority of biologists accepting evolution. The very fact of scientists against scientists is enough to create doubt and give a controversy life. And nowhere is this more true than in the second case study of this talk, climate change. Starting in 1983, NOVA has made more than a dozen hour-long documentaries on climate change. They all have one thing in common, much lower than average viewership. Climate change programs resemble medical topics like cancer and Alzheimer's disease, in that they deliver bad news that viewers just don't want to hear. But we keep trying with many different approaches. NOVA was one of the first programs to report in depth on global warming. And you can tell by the titles that our early approach was ominous. with programs like the climate crisis back in 1983, hot enough for you in 1989, warnings from the ice in 1998. In the year 2000, we made a two-hour special with Frontline, meticulously laying out the whole argument in What's Up with the Weather. As climate change became more widely reported in this decade, we turned away from the scare tactics and tried to take a more upbeat approach, emphasizing the potential economic boon of a green economy in Saved by the Sun, the big energy gamble, and power surge. We even brought in Click and Clack, the popular hosts of NPR's Car Talk, to explore the car of the future.
In a country where gas costs almost $8 a gallon, Iceland's dream is to stop importing oil by replacing conventional cars with hydrogen vehicles, if and when they come to market. In the meantime, a small fleet of buses has been warming the population to the new technology.
This is a nice bus. But it's a bus.
It's just a bus.
Oh yeah, no, there's nothing different about it except that it's a fuel cell bus, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, but it sounds the same.
No smell though, you notice that?
No smell.
No smell, which is very nice, especially in the city.
There's a little smell, but I think it's you.
No, I'm not.
Well, we're curious, when we go back to the station, can we see you refuel the bus?
Yeah.
Is there a brick wall we can stand behind?
Like gasoline, hydrogen is volatile stuff. Remember the Hindenburg? That disaster almost ruined hydrogen's reputation for good. But at the world's first public hydrogen fueling station, it's stored safely in pressurized tanks. Let's hope so, anyway.
Wait a minute now.
Wait, I want to get a look at this.
Wait a minute. Okay, go ahead.
No, we're not afraid.
No.
You got chicken pizza.
Pressurized hydrogen is pumped into storage tanks on the roof of the bus, where it's combined with oxygen in layers of thin membranes called fuel cells. Hydrogen atoms are broken apart, releasing electrons that flow through a circuit, providing electricity that propels the bus. The only emission is water vapor. Iceland prides itself on helping to improve this technology by testing it every day.
You go to a small society like Iceland, where a lot of things are simpler than a big society like the US or Europe. You can actually test the things out here. That's actually how we think we can help the world.
So after that, we tried adventure by following the exploits of photographer James Balog as he took all kinds of risks to document the melting of Greenland's glaciers.
Balog wants to get a shot that delves deep into the underbelly of the ice. The only way to secure his ropes is to thread them through the ice sheet.
You know, this ice sheet is cooking down and melting a lot, so this whole top foot and a half where you would normally put an ice screw is rotten and loose. Whereas here, we're actually using the ice sheet itself and the strength of the ice to anchor the ropes. So here we go.
A little slack.
Okay. Wow. Yay.
How about that?
These giant holes, called moulins, are thought to bore thousands of feet through the ice to the bedrock. But nobody has ever been down there to find out.
First time I've really seen the hole down there. Hey, this
and it could go any second. There it goes! It's a strange, evil, gorgeous, horrible, fantastic place.
I mean, there's hundreds of years of ice here layered in, and we're looking into the cross section of this life history of the glacier. And it's so beautiful, this insane aquamarine and all this scalloping and fluting from the water. What a spot.
Balog is just scratching below the surface of the ice sheet. Below him is another half mile of solid ice. In these compressed layers of the ice sheet, there are clues to how fast Greenland could melt.
So all of our programs follow mainstream science as expressed in the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But even where there's unanimity of opinion about climate change in general, there are disagreements about how quickly it's progressing and how bad it will get. These legitimate differences are confusing to the public. And when you add to this the fact that a small number of scientists, some with prestigious titles, take a public position against climate change, it's no surprise that many polls find a substantial decline in the number of people who believe that global warming is happening. Like evolution, the politics of climate change stirs up deep emotions. 2 years ago, we at NOVA got caught in the crossfire. The cause was a program that had nothing at all to do with today's climate crisis, since it described events far in the distant past. It was the first show in our Becoming Human series, which raised the possibility that wild swings of climate millions of years ago may have been an important factor in human evolution. This idea is advanced by paleoanthropologist Rich Potts from the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and has been published in many peer-reviewed journals. The first broadcast of the program was highly successful, but the rerun a year later created a storm of controversy. Timing is everything. And unfortunately, this encore broadcast took place the week after articles about the Koch brothers were published in the New Yorker and the Sunday New York Times. David Koch, a well-known libertarian and philanthropist, happens to be a major NOVA sponsor. So in early September in 2011, I got a call from the PBS ombudsman, Michael Gettler. Now, a call from the ombudsman is never good news. He rings up to tell you what a great job you've done. This time he said that NOVA was under fire for being anti-climate change by Joe Rahm in his influential blog, Climate Progress. Joe Rahm is a senior fellow at the liberal think tank Center for American Progress and was acting assistant secretary of energy in the Clinton administration. Rahm was joined in his criticism by several viewers. Here's a section of the show that the fuss was all about.
For the 3 million years between Toumaya and Ceylon, when brain science was flatlining, African climate was stable, dry, getting a little drier. Then came 200,000 years of wildly varying climate, careening unpredictably between wet and dry. During that time, stone tools appeared, along with the larger-brained creatures that made them. Africa was also home to many other human-like species. Climate instability put pressure on all of them.
So there are these time periods when African climate was really unstable. So anything that was living there at the time would have had to adapt to really dramatically different climate changes.
Those that couldn't adapt died out, like Salam and Lucy's kind. Better problem solvers, like Homo habilis, survived. Discoveries about ancient climate upheavals in Africa have led Rick Potts to formulate a bold theory of human evolution.
The traditional idea we have had about human evolution is that it was the savanna, the grassy plain with some trees on it, that was the driving force. But instead, what we've discovered is that climate changed all the time. And so the idea that we've come up with is that variability itself was the driving force of human evolution, and that our ancestors were adapted to change itself.
Simple but revolutionary idea. Human evolution is nature's experiment with versatility. We're not adapted to any one environment or climate, but to many. We are creatures of climate change.
I think we should actually look to our proud ancestry and how we evolved in East Africa and say, that's how we survived that, we can survive the future. Because we are that creature, because we are that smart.
Today, climate change seems to threaten our survival. But it may have held the keys to the astonishing story of how we became who we are. Because it didn't stop 2 million years ago. These dramatic upheavals would continue for another 1.5 million years. Propelling our ancestors down a road leading ultimately to the smartest creature the world has ever known.
So here is what Joe Rahm wrote, quote, "If this were just another Nova show, I'd call it a grave disappointment and seriously flawed. But since it was funded partly by the billionaire polluter David Koch, who was founder of a vast network of conservative organizations that deny the threat of global warming, the show is pure greenwashing and whitewashing that undermines the credibility of NOVA as an independent provider of objective scientific stories and analysis." Ouch. So our defense happened to be the truth, that an editorial firewall exists between our sponsors and ourselves that has never, on my watch at least, been breached. And given that we've made so many other shows endorsing mainstream scientific thinking on climate change, why all of a sudden would we bend to outside influence? We marshaled our arguments. But since it is the perception of influence that counts, not the reality, the only real saving grace was that our attackers moved on. In my view, this tempest in a teapot is typical of an issue that has become so polarized and politicized that the public is just turned off. In January of this year, there was an article on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal entitled, "No Need to Panic About Global Warming," signed by 16 scientists and engineers. A few days later, this was countered by a letter in the journal signed by an even larger group of scientists attacking the credentials of the critics. The evidence for climate change is clear as day, but for the average Joe, this point-counterpoint among scientists obfuscates everything. It contributes to the sad reality that the environmental movement, the scientific community, and the media have all failed to explain climate change in a way that will convince the lay public, or just as important, make them care. Our third and final case study doesn't threaten anybody's survival, but for this audience, it's closer to home, the multiverse. Our four-part series, The Fabric of the Cosmos, hosted by Brian Greene, focused on the last program of the multiverse, and the three strands of evidence, eternal inflation, dark energy, and string theory, that according to some scientists, appear to support it. Here's how Brian set up the program.
New York City. They say there's nowhere else like it. Home to 8 million people. Countless structures, monuments, and landmarks. Every one of them unique. Or so we think. Uniqueness is an idea so familiar, we never even question it. Experience tells us people and objects are one of a kind. Why else would we visit museums and collect great masterpieces? Yet a new picture of the cosmos is coming to light in which nothing is unique. Not that the world's great masterpieces are fakes. Instead, I'm talking about something far more profound, a new picture of the cosmos that challenges the very notion of uniqueness, one in which duplicates are inevitable. And that's just the beginning. There might be duplicates not just of objects, but of you and me and everyone else. But if this new picture is right, where are these duplicates and why haven't we ever seen them? The answer may lie outside our universe. There was a time when the word universe meant all there is, everything. The notion of more than one universe, more than one everything, seemed impossible. But perhaps, if we could go beyond our solar system, beyond the Milky Way, even beyond other distant galaxies, past the end of the observable universe, we'll find that there's more, a lot more, that our universe is not alone. There may be other universes. In fact, there might be new ones being born all the time. We may actually live in an expanding sea of multiplying universes, a multiverse. However unfamiliar and strange the multiverse might seem, a growing number of scientists think it may be the final step in a long line of radical revisions to our picture of the cosmos. That is, there was a time when we thought that the Earth was at the center of the cosmos and that everything else revolved around us. Then along came scientists like Galileo and Copernicus, and they showed us that it's the Sun, not the Earth, that's at the center of our solar system. And our solar system? It's just a little neighborhood in the outskirts of a gigantic galaxy. And our galaxy? It's one of hundreds of billions of galaxies that make up our universe. All of these ideas sounded outrageous when they were first proposed, but today we don't even question them. The idea of a multiverse may be similar. It simply may require a drastic change in our cosmic perspective. On the other hand, some scientists think that the multiverse is nothing but a dead end for physics.
I'm very uncomfortable with the multiverse. To become solid science, it's got a lot of growing up to do.
You know, it exists in the same way that, you know, angels might exist.
We have to make our bets. And I think right now the multiverse is a pretty good bet.
I think there's a good chance that the multiverse is real and that 100 years from now people might be convinced that it's real.
So for a purely theoretical topic, I've observed that discussions on the multiverse can actually get quite heated. Some scientists think that this program was wrong-headed, giving an hour of valuable airtime to a cockamamie theory, the equivalent of pseudoscience. Others think it was on target, showing how scientists can bring together new and exciting ideas, whether or not they ultimately pan out. So was this program fair? Should it have been about why the multiverse is crazy instead of why it's interesting? Should we have found more scientists to speak out against it and made sure they had more time? So first, let's examine how far the program went to endorse the multiverse. Here's a quick clip to show you how it concludes.
The multiverse, a tantalizing possibility, but with no experimental evidence, should you believe it? We can't believe in anything until there's observational or experimental support. But what we have found over the last few centuries is that mathematics provides a sure-footed guide to the nature of things that we haven't yet been able to see, observe, or experiment with. Math predicted things like black holes and certain subatomic particles long before we ever observed them. And math is suggesting that there may be these other universes. That doesn't mean it's right, but often it's leading you to a deeper understanding of reality.
If you choose not to believe it, that's perfectly fine, because we have not given you any evidence yet. And one of the wonderful things about science is it's about evidence, it's not about belief.
So I hardly consider that a ringing endorsement. But whether or not it is, I think the show served an important purpose. As we've seen in this talk, there are many shades of scientific controversy. Some are colored by religion, others by politics. But when there are legitimate differences among scientists focused on the science itself, it's important that they see the light of day. In a world filled with hype and opinion, lay people often view science as a body of knowledge that's certain. An open and honest debate among scientists opens the door to a more realistic and process-oriented view. So for the journalist, however uncomfortable it may be to parse these differences, that makes going out on the edge and wading into areas where scientists disagree totally worthwhile. Now, I'd be happy to take your questions.
I'm sure there are many questions. I'll start.
I was sure you would.
Your presentation was as beautifully edited as most Nobel program models, but my problem with Brian Greene's presentation was multiple, explain a few points. There were four episodes. Most of them had to do with pretty well-established science, trying to explain quantum mechanics, where once again there were many Brian Greene's, it seems to be typical of what he does. The last one was highly speculative, theoretical mathematical physics. And yet it was put together with the others as if it was on the same. The part of my objection was there was very little distinction made between, except for those from kind of pro forma remarks at the end there, between that part of theoretical speculation and trying to explain the fabric of the cosmos, which happens to be Brian's book. So it was partly a book-selling program. Brian, you tell me, controlled the content completely. The last thing, which was a highly speculative endeavor, was not presented as a debate, and I think the other side to Brian's telling us all that we have now discovered through mathematical formalism the existence of an infinite number of Brian Greene out there was not presented, I thought was totally manipulative in the way the issue was put. As one who was interviewed by you guys for 4 hours, the snippets that were chosen were not representative of the arguments that were made. I do not think it makes it, you see, I mean, in a debate over climate and evolution, which are like shooting fish in a barrel, to present the debate, even in those cases, the two points of view were much better represented. As far as I could tell, in that program, Brian would say, to be sure, it's quite, some people deny that there might exist an infinite number of universes that we could ever communicate with, an infinite number of Brian Greens. Fast switch to half a sentence from someone. switch back, but, you know, time will tell, and we have no evidence yet, but it's coming. So I felt it was incredibly, what you were doing were, I presume, were giving this time to somebody who has a particular point of view, selling a book, and presenting it as if it was a debate or an open question. Although somebody who looks at that program, the people representing the other side are as silly as the people opposing evolution or climate change.
Well, you know, I mean, David, we've discussed this before, and I knew in doing this part of the, you know, I felt like I had to do the multiverse, and as I said, I think that these, I never intended to conflate climate change, evolution, and multiverse. I think they, as I said, disagreement comes in different shades. And I think this one is an honest disagreement that's focused on the science. And that's why it was interesting for the audience. All I can say is we worry.
A debate in which the person who shapes the presentation is presenting one point of view, which is the selling point in a book he's selling, without letting a debate occur.
Well, Steve.
You know, it's interesting. David has, I think, voiced some of the strongest concerns about the multiverse. A few of us have concerns, but a lot of our colleagues have embraced this as a valid line of pursuit, like it or not. There are quite a few people in our area who have really taken this quite seriously.
Yeah, and I have to say that I wanted to present this morning for a reason, because I think of the three case studies I presented, by far the most difficult one is the multiverse, because it is very difficult, both for the public, but more so for journalists, to parse arguments when they really are focused on science. You can see in climate change and you can see in evolution that these are debates that are really colored by outside factors. And this is not the only debate. When we did a program once on quantum mechanics, it was a program, maybe some of you remember it, it's called Parallel Lives. And it was about a rock star whose father was a physicist and came up with the multi-worlds theory in his doctoral dissertation at Princeton University. We showed it around because we were worried that some of the program, which was originally a BBC program, was incorrect. We showed it to 25 physicists, and basically we got 12 answers, and this was all about the wave function and the way it breaks down. So they were disagreeing for scientific reasons on the breakdown of the wave functions. And my producer said to me, these physicists are like snowflakes. They're falling all over the place. And I think that's simply an interesting example, as is the multiverse, about how journalists have to cope with internal scientific debates that actually are very interesting for the public and I think give a very positive view of scientists, of science, not as a body of certain knowledge, but as something that is forming and being added to all the time. So I think to not do this, and I know, David, we have to kind of agree to disagree about the way this program is done, and I'm certainly not here to say that it was done in the most perfect way possible, and you know, if we were to do over again, you know, there are certain elements of it that I would change, but it was a tough program, and we worried it to death. It wasn't just that we, you know, and to defend Brian, honestly, I don't think selling a book had anything to do about it. But I think you're correct in the sense to raise the point that there is different depending upon which side of the argument you stand on. And I thought, actually, in the program, the critics were strong and important. So, and I know that you have a different view of them.
Yeah. I disagree with some of the things David says, but this is different from many of your notes, where in many of the notes, science, an array of scientists have to present the subject. Mm-hmm. And in Brian's series, it's the Brian Show. Brian tells the entire story, and every once in a while there's a cut to David or me or someone else who basically either gives a snippet of a disagreement or disagreement, but doesn't get to tell any coherent story. And I think that's not typical of anything. I mean, these are the only shows you do that are like that.
Yeah, we have.
And obviously, you do it for a reason. I mean, obviously, it has an appeal to me. But I think it is not as. And I think you actually did a very good job of telling science. The case, you know, the scientific story. In that set, but it's different from most of your other.
Yes, and I think you're very right in acknowledging that when there's a host, it's that person's story. On the other hand, I have to say that doesn't cause us to just depart from, you know, established journalistic practice. We don't just say, you know, Brian, whatever you have to say, this is just fine. It's a partnership, and you have to work it out.
Well, it's interesting. So in that last segment, for example. You had, as usual, probably a few percent of the footage you shot could be used. Mm-hmm. So how did the debate part, you made an argument, which I think was, we've heard from Galileo and Newton, the many stars. Mm-hmm. Most of those are observational learnings, of course, but who presented that? Who chose, the opposite viewpoint? It was as if, see, when you did the evolution thing, which is from a science point of view is indeed shooting fish in a barrel, you presented, based on court transcripts, the actual debate.
But I think that, David, that Richard can tell you, we were in the evolution show, we were extremely upset and worried that we couldn't get any of these anti-evolution scientists to talk to us because it makes us look unfair. Richard, you want to say something?
Well, I mean, those court transcripts were, as Paul said, thousands. They were 6,000 pages, and we probably chose, 40? Very, very few. The second thing that I think is important here is I think that there's a dichotomy between what you did with climate change and evolution today and what you did with multiverse in the sense that the preposition is different. Climate change and evolution are in many ways uncontroversial in science. Not in all ways, but in many ways. Obviously, evolution more than climate change. And so, in a sense, that's controversy about science when you bring in society. Multiverse is really not that. It is controversy in science. And so it's a very different kind of issue. To speak to the question of other hosts, Dan Gilbert, who did This Emotional Life with another series that Paul and I did together, was the host of that series. We were assiduous about the science, and yet he drove much of the story. When you did Stephen Jay Gould's story, several shows on Stephen, he did the story. When John Hemingway, a producer friend of ours, did a show on Robert Sapolsky on stress, it was Sapolsky's perspective on stress that drove that hour. So it is not uncommon at all for journalists to take an individual, highlight that person's perspective, and yet sort of cut away at the edges to make sure that the audience understands where it sits in the spectrum.
Because Nova still owns, or the broadcaster still owns responsibility for the journalistic integrity of the story. And that's why, honestly, criticism, these programs are hard to handle. I think it's interesting to have a point of view. It's established, but it does make it very tough to handle. But I do also want to say that Brian was very enthusiastic about having other voices. It's not like he said, I don't want to hear any of the scientists against it. No, that really is the case. And whether or not we did it correctly, that's our responsibility. Yes.
I think you have to draw the line, the distinction between like the Brian Green thing and multiverses, which is pure speculative science. Science, but it's far from being there. It's the job of theoretical physicists to come up with crazy ideas and get enough people excited about the idea that they work on it, and eventually 20 years down the road, either it'll be proved right or be proved wrong, but there's a long path between one and the other. Until that gels, I don't see what the public gains from learning that this guy has a crazy idea, and it might be right, most likely it's wrong just because it's too new to really tell one way or another. And yes, if it were to be true, it might be a neat idea, but it's just adding non-facts to their brains where, and they have no, the public has no way to judge. They can't participate in the debate because there's no way that they have the tools, you know, at their disposal to understand, you know, the equations or what's involved. I just don't see what the public gets from the fact that, because it looks like people arguing just, you know, for arguing, which is actually what's happening, because when you sign on to a crazy idea like this, I mean, people adopt it because they like the idea, and it wouldn't be nice if it was true, and that's why they decide to devote, you know, a couple years of their life to pursuing, you know, how could I prove it, how can I not prove it, what would it mean, and so forth and so on. But that's a far cry from, you know, reporting that if you want to do speculative science, you have to do it in some completely different way. I don't see what the public gets from it other than being confused, because it's just like these guys say this and these guys say that, and you see they don't know anything about anything.
Yep.
Well, most of these questions are comments, not questions. So I'll give you mine. What's interesting is that this...
I knew this would spark a lot of discussion.
This entire group, maybe except for a couple of us, are all scientists. And you're really invested in the accuracy of the underlying debate. So I'm not. I'm just a member of the public. And I actually saw the program when it was on. So I can give you a public perspective, which is, I thought it was fascinating. I have no idea if it's true. We won't know, probably, in our lifetime, maybe for many lifetimes after that. But to have a program that shows the possibility of entertaining really wild ideas, I thought was stimulating and interesting. And I have to say, David, I thought you came across great, and the ideas presented as speculative, and I think that's perfectly fine. Not all journalism has to be reporting the facts. This has, as a member of the lay public, I was fascinated to see it. It doesn't seem that much crazier to me than quantum mechanics or space theory. There are a lot of things that seem crazy. So I guess let me just finish the talk. I think we have an enormous problem in our country that people are not taking education and interest in science seriously. So I think NOVA plays an enormously valuable role in stimulating people's excitement. And, you know, you can overthink it. I think it was a provocative program, and that's good. It doesn't have to be on
program. We did our series on string theory, that's almost 10 years ago. String theory seemed pretty crazy, too. Other comments? There was a comment here.
Actually, I didn't have a comment, I had a question.
Great.
So I was just wondering, I mean, even at the beginning of your talk, you were talking about the difficulties and the challenges when there's this controversy in the U.S. So I guess I'm wondering, with Prince Charles speaking on genetically modifying organisms and the UEA release of classified documents on climate change, if that ever, the controversy surrounding it within the scientific community or between the scientific community and royalty even, ever presents itself as an opportunity for you to, you know, when something comes up like this. I mean, I guess this case, the trial that you did,
was
an example, but is that often a kind of lightning rod to, or is the editorial and processing time too long to respond?
Richard, do you want to take that?
Well, there's nothing as good as what happened in evolution. Mm-hmm. And that was a perfect storm for the journalist, because it was all there. Mm-hmm. It made the whole, it was inherent drama. It made it easy to sort of go after it and do it the way we wanted to do it. We'd been looking for the opportunity. We'd done a series together on evolution that was 8 hours long, aired in 2001. We'd been looking for years to find another way to go back into it, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, to David's credit, he accepted me as journalist in residence the day before the Multiverse show was on. I wrote back to him and I said, maybe you want to wait a day. But he was brave. Yes, up here.
Yeah, I'm just, this month there happened to be a large number of mathematicians in residence also. And of course, there's never any controversy in mathematics, because everything we do is true. It's just irrelevant. It's generally irrelevant. And so I don't want to come back to David, the debate between David and you, but what I'm curious about, since I believe there's been one NOVA program on pure mathematics, maybe there's a topologist here too, that's a central area of mathematics, and I think it figured in that one program. But you see, what I wonder is how you choose what you really want to focus on in these things, because it does seem that, that journalism tends to gravitate towards controversy, and perhaps to side with David briefly, that choosing something like the multiverse as a mathematician who knows a little bit about theoretical physics, that seems like a multiverse of different theories of nature, and I was surprised you chose that. And I'm wondering whether fields like mathematics, where, you know, again, there's not a controversy over its truth, there's a question of what's central, what's important, what's relevant, how you folks at NOVA, or journalists in general, choose things to cover. I mean, mathematicians have
I thought Brian did some great PR for math in that last
Yes and no. I mean, it's a very limited area of mathematics that's covered. And you know, mathematicians, topologists in particular, have a pretty good idea what the central questions are, and those that are remain open, those that have been resolved, how the structure of the theory fits together, and it's hard to deal with, and I don't think NOVA would find many people wanting to watch it. It would put people to sleep.
The question, we've got about 4 programs on math, which is admittedly not very many, but we love math programs, and they actually do very well. The problem is, of course, the obvious: mathematics is highly abstract, and it's hard to find stories that you can focus on that are understandable and that you can visualize. But for example, in the case of Andrew Wiles proving Fermat's Last Theorem, that was a great story. We showed a piece of it at one of my talks. I showed the whole program to my class in the film studies department at UCSB, and for the most part, they loved it. That was a character study.
What's that? I wasn't complaining about the lack of something. You have to choose things that have that type of appeal to the general public, and that by nature takes a lot of things.
I mean, we really choose things that have an appeal to us. I mean, that's the dirty little secret. And you know, you also want I love research on Alzheimer's disease and cancer, but I'm not going to do it every day because I know nobody will watch the show. So there are certain realities about having to make some number of shows you know will be popular, and that reality is getting worse and worse and more restrictive as funds get more and more limited. It's a really bad trend that I see, but it happens to be the reality. So you have to balance. You know, I always say you're balancing the education and the entertainment, and that's kind of the art of it. Anybody can make strictly educational programs. Anybody can make them if they're just entertaining, and that goes for topic choice as well. But you can be sure that if there is a good story on mathematics, and when there is, that's not something we would turn down because we think it won't be popular. We have a special set of viewers. They're really, the NOVA viewers are amazing. And they will, if we do it right, they will watch programs in areas like mathematics. We just need to come up with a good story that kind of gets our juices going. Over here.
I noticed when you were discussing evolution, there were really 2 different venues of criticism. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, there is intelligent design, and I think it was very effectively discussed. The other one, where it started out, was the connection between Darwin's theory and the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And you didn't address that. There wasn't any further discussion except, and that's a very different kind of thing. It's not the question if it's scientifically right or wrong, but is it good or bad for us? Did the type of moral shift towards Darwinian thinking actually lead us to treat disabled people with different ethnic background as undesirable, because thus basically certified by Darwinian theory? Were there scientists actually involved in it? I think in the United States there were, in fact, biologists directly involved in eugenics. And
right.
I believe that Galton, the nephew of Darwin, Francis Galton, who's a very respectable scientist, started the eugenics war in England.
All science can be misused.
No, that's not
and
right.
It is.
It's good for us. Can science produce a moral shift towards for society towards the bad side? That's my question.
Well, I mean, I showed that clip because I actually saw the whole movie. We were, after Judgment Day, we were, this movie was shown by invitation only in theaters throughout the country. And by mistake, they invited us. And so we all kind of went into the whole Judgment Day team. We went into the theater not really knowing what to expect. And they checked our, searched our purses. I mean, it was very, very weird. And, you know, Ben Stein is a smart guy. He's a very smart guy. And that movie, you know, had extremely high production values. I'm sure it cost $10 million to produce or somewhere near that. And it was such a cheap shot, in my opinion. Now, that's not to say that I don't think that science can be misused, and we all see examples of legitimate, you know, scientific theories. You know, I'm sure Lisa Meitner, you know, when she explained fission, was, you know, not thinking of what would happen at the end of World War II. But that is, that's something that everyone knows. I wanted to show you this clip because I think that there is no limit to where the intelligent design movement will go. I found that film, and I have it if you ever want to see it, I found that horrendous. And what happened was they had a Q&A afterwards, and Joe McMaster, our producer, started to ask them questions and challenge some of this, and we were removed from the theater. So, I think that watching that clip, I mean, it just made me so angry that I really wanted to share it with you. But that does not, the fact is that we all know that science has, legitimate theories have a flip side. So yes, but I don't think that you reject Darwinian evolution because it can be misused by eugenicists. I don't know if that's a very good answer. I'm not much of a philosopher. Anyway, over here.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm not sure whether I answered this properly. So we had three topics, right?
Mm-hmm.
One was about evolution. The second one was about climate change. Uh-huh. And the last one was about the multiverse. But the second movie you showed in the climate part was, as far as I understood, was not questioning that there are changes of climate, but they are claiming that changes of climate in climate are good. In a way, yeah. Good for you, for mankind.
That were good, yes.
It was saying that don't worry about it; it will make us stronger. But if you look at it, it's extremely cynical because it takes more or less. It's the same idea of this Holocaust Darwinism, saying that what does it mean is that many people will die. So if we have this change again, mm-hmm. because of these changes of climate, many of us will die. They accept this. They say that's good.
This is exactly how Joe Rahn thought. This is what he thought. And looking at that clip, you know, had I to do it again, I think I would have taken out Mark Maslin's piece because I think it could be understood. Mark Maslin is not saying, he is a highly well-recognized scientist. He is not saying, I think climate change is good in 2012. He was saying that climate change was a factor in human evolution. That's pretty well established.
What should I conclude from it?
Pardon me?
What should be my conclusion for the future? We have this discussion at the moment. Should we spend money in order to suppress, pollution and all this would cost a lot of money and will in the end cause lowering our standard of life? Or should we not? And this kind of movie gives you the idea of everything is fine, let's go on.
Well, but that's your interpretation of it. That is certainly not what the speaker meant. I agree it's clearly open to misunderstanding and exploitation, which I think
it's dangerous.
What?
It's a hidden message.
I don't think it was. I think what you see is what you get. And it was not intended as a hidden message. Why ever would we communicate that message?
Why did you emphasize this? Indeed, as you said, he only said climate change was a contributing factor to human evolution. Mm-hmm. And then he stopped. And then other people started to add these things. Oh, the climate's changing again. And now, look, blah, blah, blah. We're adapted to this. This extra spin was put on by you later.
He was saying,
why?
No, Mark Maslin was saying we can cope with it. I think you could use that as an argument for doing something about it. So it's in, people are taking that, and as I said, now looking at it, I mean, my mind was in, we're talking about 2 million years ago. I was not interpreting, I'd never interpreted. Now, perhaps I wasn't smart enough. I can understand why you would interpret that, but that was not the way he intended it. Mark Maslin is a climate scientist, and a very good one, and not a climate change denier in any way. What he's saying is,
there were two ways he could have ended that. I was waiting for the, but now we can cope with it. We have evolved to the point where we can, right, we can measure it, recognize it, and deal with it. Right. Instead he said, we've adapted to be diverse, so we can deal with it.
Well, that's an interpretation. I don't think that's what he was saying. Clearly, had I thought that was what he was saying, the piece would never have been in there. Looking at it now, with the benefit of hindsight, maybe I wouldn't have used it. Yes?
I have a more general question. So I think in all three of the pieces you chose, there was controversy, but a lot of the controversy was not so much about the scientific facts, but the interpretations of them. So obviously we've got other factors like religion and politics coming in, but even in the multiverse story, you know, a lot of the debate is about different people's opinions about metaphysics rather than about evidence. I mean, there is evidence, there is no one way or the other. So how do you distinguish in your journalism? How do you distinguish between scientific facts and evidence and opinions about metaphysics and philosophy? And is that your responsibility, or is that the responsibility of the scientists you're interviewing to make that distinction clear?
It's always our responsibility. It's always our responsibility.
Right.
But you try to do it. I mean, there is a fine line between giving scientists their say and not constantly muzzling them. I mean, people have to take some responsibility for what it is that they say, and it would be wrong of us to try to take what they say and shape it into our point of view. That's not something that we try to do. And that was something that I was thinking about with Maslin. He said it, let him live with it. And I think that that was, you know, that was my thinking at the time. Would it be different now? I don't know. I have to really think about that. But as what you're saying is, you try to distinguish in the narration always what is fact, what is opinion, and whether or not there's any evidence for it. But as I said, there are different shades of disagreement. There are disagreements that are basically religious. I think that's where evolution is. There are disagreements that are basically political. And I think a lot of climate change is about that. And you have to point that out to viewers. But there are many scientists, there's a small number of scientists who disagree with the climate change conclusions of the IPCC, would say that it's not political. So, you know, it's not easy. That's why we get the big bucks. I figured out long.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of what you're experiencing here real time is peer review. And except you're not the peer of the scientists. So, you know, whenever I've dealt with journalists, some subset of them would say, well, you know, maybe I'll send you the article before it appears in case I got something really wrong. But don't expect me to really necessarily, you can't rewrite the article, you can't. So my question to you is, how do you close that loop a bit with your community you're interacting with so that, you know, a reaction like David's is something you know in advance, and say, well, maybe we have gone a little bit wrong, or they're actually getting into the climate change. What's your mechanism by which you might capture some of those?
We have an enormous fact-checking operation.
I'm asking for a response from the scientific community.
Right. So what we tend to do, and especially when you're wading into areas of disagreement, is to try to find advisors, scientific advisors, who don't necessarily have a dog in the fight, but who are in the field enough so that they're aware of what the different currents are. And they can let us know what exactly the response will be so that we'll be prepared. And that they can help us. I mean, our advisors keep us from making mistakes. And so as far as fact-checking goes, you know, we're very careful about that, because even a very tiny error and errors always tend to creep in, as everyone knows, can completely undermine your credibility. So you want to have your program be error-free. We have a program this fall, which is on the archaeology of Easter Island, these statues that were constructed thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago, by the people on Easter Island. And the archaeology of Easter Island, and archaeology in general, is so much more nasty than this. I can't even begin to tell you. Probably because the stakes are so low. It's very, very difficult. And this program, we know that we're going to get it. And we have advisors who are telling us how. We fact-check the programs. And that's, I think, the way that we do it, is by really having trusted advisors who can at least guide us through these troubled waters. Yes?
So in the days of YouTube, some people can just clip a 3 minutes clip that makes, you know, from the program and make the point, and to produce something controversial by, you know, just focusing on that 3 minutes of particular content. So how does you deal with that problem? Is that entering the consciousness of the production?
I think YouTube really helps to polarize things to an unreasonable degree. If you, you know, look at evolution, especially in climate change, I mean, you have clips with, you know, millions of views, some of which are just completely unreasonable. And you find that people who are opposed to climate change, they watch those clips and it makes them feel really good about their views. And people on the other side watch the other clips. And it's clearly, I think it's just exacerbating the problem in our society that we're not really talking to each other. And so, I mean, I think that that's...
But the problem is that in the old days, when your whole program is balanced, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But now the problem is, even if your program is on the whole balance, you know, some particular portion of it, which may be just for a second, could be used by someone for political agenda. So is there any...
It's like taking something out of context. Even
right.
Before there were
right.
Video, you could do that with words.
Absolutely. I mean, and it happens all the time. And if we see it and we think it's egregious, we try to... I mean, you know, we have people who are looking for this stuff. We get it taken down. So, Richard?
Just an interesting little factoid about that and dialogue. In, I think, 1960, the average political soundbite was 43 seconds long on television, and now it's about 9.
Yeah.
I think there's another problem here, because not only the fact-checking and being balanced, but also our simplification of science brings people to wrong conclusions, I think. Because, for example, theory of relativity or quantum mechanics or even evolution is often used in the wrong context, because trying to make it closer to the people, journalists usually oversimplify to the point that brings people to understanding in the wrong way. So you create controversy by making stuff more interesting and like reducing it into something that is not. How do you deal with this kind of problem? So bringing the topic closer to people, but keeping the science in. So the science has to be correct still in the final piece.
We try to make the science correct. I mean, that's how we deal with it. We try not to reduce it by simplifying, to reduce it to something that's not. I mean, you have to simplify. This is television. There's no two ways about it. And I believe on balance, it's much better to make these ideas available to people. After all, they do pay for them in large part. So they have a right to know what's going on, and they want to know what's going on. And if we want to stimulate interest in science and technology, as Derek mentioned, you have to do this. But the effort, and it is a huge effort, is not to simplify, oversimplify in a dumb way that gives people a misleading impression. And again, as responding to what Laura said, we work with scientists on that. It doesn't just come out of our heads. We're not that smart. So we're entirely indebted to the scientific community to for supporting our efforts, they're talking to us, and that's why we get really upset when scientists really disagree with what we've done, which happens from time to time. More upset, for example, than we get when politicians disagree. People who clearly have a political agenda disagree. When scientists disagree, we really try to understand what it was that we did.
So to come up with, to say, I would like to understand how to present a scientific debate. Now, a scientific debate works by a bunch of people coming together, like to understand something, they disagree, they look at the evidence, they look at the math, look at all this, and at the end of the day, after some honest discourse, you come up with some solution. It might take a while, but this is an honest debate. The problem is, both evolution and climate change is not such a debate. I have a very strong opinion, maybe I'm wrong, but I have the opinion that one side of this debate is spinning the truth. And if something like this is going on, the question is, should I present it differently? To make an example outside of this this case, if you take the question, does smoking tobacco cause lung cancer, was a long debate. Okay. And the tobacco industry came up with all kinds of scientific evidence and doctors that were saying, no, it doesn't, we have all these studies. And it was presented as if it's an honest debate, but it later came out and it was kind of known if you look deeper. They had all the studies in their own safe which says that's going to cause lung cancer, and they were ultimately convicted of that. If you know about these things, and if you know there's a guy who has a big stake, wouldn't that tell you it can't be presented as if it's an honest scientific debate?
I agree with you completely. We have no disagreement. Absolutely.
But then you would
there are different shades of controversy.
Things. I mean, it's not just this guy has a good argument, this guy has a bad argument. This the guy with a bad argument is spinning the truth. I mean, he's completely impervious to any.
Well, for the most part, you see, they don't think that they're spinning the truth. These are not the people in evolution. I don't believe that Michael Behe is some cynical guy who's, and Richard may disagree with me. I think he really believes this. And so, but it's clear that this whole intelligent design debate is, as the judge found, is colored by religion. I don't know, Richard?
Well, I don't, it's not really my show here. But there's a clip in, or a segment in Judgment Day, which if Paul had shown it, and it's a great clip, it's called we call it the smoking gun clip, where we actually, in an anthropologist named Barbara Forrest, looked at a manuscript that had been developed for pandas and people before and after a court decision in 1987, and found that they were exactly the same with the words creationist changed to, what was it?
Intelligent design. They merged the words.
And they had simply replaced, and they had actually done a bad job of replacing, and so you could actually see the vestiges of the word creationist in there. So, of course, you're exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, and that's why you have to look at the subtext. Anything else? Well, thank you very much.